So clearly articulated rules are a double-edged sword, aren't they? If you think about it, on the positive side, if somebody clearly articulates what the expectations are for you, then you all of a sudden have these boundaries that you can operate inside of. And as long as you operate inside of those boundaries, you have all this peace and all this relaxation. If you are driving 64 in a 65 mile per hour zone and you zoom past a police officer, you don't even have to look in the rearview mirror, because you're safe inside the boundaries that they've established for you. Clearly articulated rules do have a positive purpose in our lives. We have less stress, we have less worry, and our lives generally operate better. But, some of you are already growling at me, there are downsides to clearly articulated rules too, right? The first downside that I can see is they cramp our style. There's a lot less freedom when you have clearly articulated rules. You don't have as much room to spread your wings and do things your way. This is for my wife. As Anne of Green Gables would put it, there's just no scope for imagination, right? In a black and white world like that. And the more you get restricted and the more you bump up against the edges of those boundaries, it starts to pick at you after a while, doesn't it? And after a while, this curiosity starts to arise inside of your heart that says, I wonder what it would be like outside of that boundary. What would it be like just this once, just to kind of break that, just to step outside of the rules and just live as a rebel? I wonder what that would be like. Could I get away with it? I don't know, but it might be fun to try. And the more clearly articulated the rules are, the more likely we feel over time to break and to disobey and to try to see what happens outside of those boundaries and those rules. So there are some downsides. Another downside is that clearly articulated rules make you accountable to a higher power, don't they? I mean, it's one thing if you're driving down the highway. It's funny, I use a lot of driving illustrations when it comes to rules. I wonder if the Spirit of God is trying to speak to me. But anyway, you're driving down the highway, you get on the highway, and you never see a speed limit sign. And you're cruising along at 75 because cars can drive safely at that speed these days. And you go along and you're like, yay, everything's great, everything's wonderful. A cop pulls you over and he says, sir, this is a 65 mile per hour zone. What are you doing? You can always say to the guy, what? I never saw a sign. I didn't know. As long as the rules are not clearly articulated, you can pretend that you didn't know. You at least have some hope that when you stand in front of the judge might cut you some slack. But what if there's a placard every 500 feet along the highway? 65. No, seriously, 65. No, really, 65. I don't mean it like, you know, the suggestion 65, the speed limit is 65, boom, 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 boom. And then the police officer stops you. And you're like, sir, I didn't know. He is not going to be very sympathetic to your case. You go before the judge, you say, your honor, it was 500 feet. How am I supposed to remember something when I'm driving for 500 feet? The judge is going to look at you and say, I'm sorry. We were very clear. We articulated the standard. We told you what the boundaries were. And when you break them, you're going to be held accountable for breaking those. And I'll be honest with you, the punishment for you is probably going to be a little bit steeper than it would be for somebody who didn't know the rules. So, in summary, if you obey the rules, right, there's the one side of clearly articulated rules. If you obey the rules, you're safe inside the boundaries. You don't have to worry about things. You don't have to be stressed out. You can kind of just relax. But on the flip side, not only does the rule itself make you curious about being a rule breaker, but also now that you've been given the rules, you're going to be held accountable for whether or not you actually obey them. So it cuts both ways. It has its good points, but it also has its bad points. Now, the reason I talk about this as we get started this morning is that the chapter in God's story that we looked at last week asked us at the end this simple question. Why in the world did God give people rules to follow? And I spent most of the message trying to debunk this horrible idea that has come to us from religion, that God gave us the rules as an entrance exam into his family. That if you have the rules and you keep the rules to a certain standard, then you get in. And when you're in with God, things can be cool with you and God. That's what I spent 75% of my sermon last week trying to break us of this idea, because it's a horrible idea. It doesn't emerge anywhere from the Bible. God doesn't do that. God establishes relationship not by you following rules. God establishes relationship by rescuing people. He rescues them and a relationship is established long before there are any rules for them to follow. And we know that specifically because before God gave his people the Ten Commandments or the 450 other commandments in the Old Testament, he had already rescued them from being slaves in Egypt. And now that they've been through that, now that they've cried out to God for rescue and God rescued them, they have a relationship with God, and then God gives them the rules. And we looked at last week, we talked about it just briefly at the end, that the reason God gave them rules was so that they could learn to be like him, to act like him, to care about the things he cared about. And as they would learn to follow these rules, they would show the world around them what God was like and what their life could be like if they let God rule over them too. The reason God gave people rules was so they could be successful in impacting the world around them. And as they lived to be like God, showing the world what God was like, the entire world would benefit from that. And they would have the blessings that God always intended to bring to the world. Their obedience would impact the world around them. But as we move on to the next chapter of story, clearly articulated rules can be a double-edged sword. With greater knowledge comes greater responsibility, greater accountability to actually keep them. Let me show you what I mean. Open up your Bibles to the book of Deuteronomy chapter 30. You were already in Deuteronomy 5 earlier for our worship theme. Now let's move on just a few pages to Deuteronomy chapter 30. It's in the seat Bibles. If you want to grab one of those in front of you, no problem. It's on page 172. 172. And in this, just so you know what's going on here, God is wrapping up an extended conversation with the Jewish people at the bottom of the mountain about how God wants them to live. And he's wrapping it all up, and Moses is going to put some final words of challenge out to these people who have been given all of these promises. Take a look at verse 15 of Deuteronomy 30. Deuteronomy 30, verses 15, and I'm going to read down through verse 20, so about a paragraph. So hang in there with me. Verse 15. See, Moses says, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you today, by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways, and by keeping his commandments and his statutes and his rules, then you shall live and multiply. And the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. It's pretty straightforward, right? If you obey these rules, if you stay inside these boundaries I've set up for you, things are going to go really well for you. You're going to have the blessing of God that you long for, that you really want. You're going to live long and have a prosperous life, and it's not said here, but you will also be a witness to the nations that there is a God in heaven who loves them. So if you obey, if you stay inside the boundaries, it's going to be great. You're going to love it. You're going to love your life. But there's more. Verse 17. But if your heart turns away, and you will not hear, but are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today, you shall surely perish. You shall not live long in the land that you are going over the Jordan to enter and possess. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I've set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life, that you and your offspring may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice, and holding fast to him. For he is your life and length of days, that you may dwell in the land that the Lord promised or swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give them. Do you see what he's saying? He's like, on the one hand, okay, if you obey, everything's going to be good. If you disobey, sadly, there are going to be consequences for breaking those clearly articulated rules. You're not going to be able to now look at God and say, oh, I didn't know I was supposed to stay faithful to you. It's the number one commandment. If you forget all the other 10 or the other 9, you remember the first one, you'll be fine. The first commandment was you will have no other gods. One God, exclusive devotion, just me and you. No other gods are going to get in the middle of our relationship. And he says, if you forget that, if you turn away from that, if you abandon that, even though I've been so explicitly clear about what I expect of you, you will face consequences. And so Moses ends this little section the same way I would as your pastor. I would look at you and say, I have set in front of you two options here. There's life on this hand, and there's death on this hand. Please choose life, right? Do what God says. Allow the boundaries he builds for you to be boundaries that you can stay inside of and get comfortable with. Because outside of those boundaries is all the things you want to avoid in your life. God's judgment and even death and punishment is outside of the boundaries. Stay inside the boundaries, and not only will you be blessed by God, you will be a blessing to the world. You will send the world a message that there's a God who wants to renew relationship with broken people. If you stay inside the boundaries, choose life. Now, that's just obvious, right? How easy is that? I mean, come on. You lay out the options. One of them is clearly right, and it leads to good places. The other one is clearly wrong. It leads to bad places. I mean, all we need, right, is just to know what to do. All we need God to do is show up and tell us, this is what I want you to do. If God would just be clear with us, there wouldn't be any problems, right? We would always choose the thing that's best for us, wouldn't we? If we just know what that is, some of you are smirking already because you know how the story unfolds, don't you? Some of you don't even have to know how the story for Israel unfolds because you know your story. And you know that when you know things that you're supposed to do or not supposed to do, that doesn't guarantee you actually do them, does it? There's something in your heart that wants you to go a different direction. You see, our problem, I think, isn't just that we don't have enough clarity about what God wants us to do. It's not that we don't have enough information. We have a problem on the inside that is actually made worse when God clearly articulates his expectations of us. Honestly, if you want to admit it or not, it's true, I think. Each of us has a rebel spirit inside of us, just waiting for the opportunity to reveal itself. So, the question we're going to talk about for just a few more minutes this morning is this. How did it turn out for Israel? How did they do? How did they do with all these clearly articulated rules? Should have been the easiest thing in the world, right? For them to stay inside the boundaries and be blessed by God and then be a blessing to the rest of the world? Or did they make another choice? I'm glad you asked me, actually, because I want to give you a quick recap of their history and kind of talk about this. So, you probably won't be surprised to hear this, but God was faithful to his side of the deal. They're a nation of people. They have no homeland. They're wandering around in the desert. At the bottom of this mountain, God says, I'm going to take you into a land. I'm going to clear out your enemies in front of you. You're going to be able to enjoy this land. It's going to be wonderful. I made promises to your great-granddaddy Abraham, and now you are going to be the beneficiaries of this promise. And God did that. He moved everything. He took care of things. The walls of Jericho, which one of the cities in there, fell down by God's miraculous power, and the people entered into the land, started to build their cities, live in their homes, plant their fields, and everything was going great. They were staying inside of the boundaries. But very soon the people got restless. You see, when they conquered this land, they were supposed to push out the people who had lived there previously. And the Bible is very clear, you're not supposed to intermarry and connect with them because they will lead your heart away from God. They will introduce new gods into your world, and that is recipe for disaster when it comes to God. So push them out in front of you. Don't have anything to do with them. Don't let your kids marry them. Just stay focused on following, stay inside the boundaries. And it didn't take very long before they started to do the exact opposite. They didn't just not push them out, they welcomed them in. They started to intermarry and interact and have all these connections together. Now, I don't know if it's just that the Canaanites around them were that cool and they just wanted to be like the Canaanites. I don't know if maybe they started to bump up against the edges of the boundaries and they're like, oh, this is kind of a bummer. We have to take a day off work. We can't just keep working and making money. We got to stop and relax. this is kind of crazy. I know this other God over here lets me do whatever I want. I don't know what it was. All I know is that in a short amount of time, their loyalty to God that they had expressed at the bottom of the mountain is gone. And they start flirting with other gods. And very soon after the flirtation, they flat out break their covenant and agreement with God. And they start to worship these gods openly and flagrantly. And if you follow their history over the next several hundred years, what you see is a story a lot like our story. Most of the time, they're struggling to stay faithful to God. And then every now and then something happens and they turn it around. And for a short amount of time, they're doing what God wants them to do. And God says, hey, you're inside the boundaries. I can bless you again. And they go and have a wonderful time reconnecting with God. And then they get bored and they get tired and they get restless and they start wandering outside the boundaries and they struggle again. And it's this up and down ping pong kind of existence. And not only that, the longer they go in this pattern of back and forth, the longer they stay in the bad place before they get back to the good. And the sooner they slip out of the good back into the bad. I mean, most of the time they're completely off the wagon. They abandon God completely. They do the exact opposite of what God asked them to do. So God comes up with a strategy. And this strategy is to send specific messengers to his people to try to call them back to him. This group of people is called prophets. And God sends prophets time and time again to his people. Now, here's the thing about it, okay? Usually when a prophet shows up, it's not good news they're going to be sharing. Okay? They're going to say a lot of stuff about your agreement with God and how you broke your agreement. It's kind of like all those bills that come in that you really don't want to open. Kind of get on, you know, kind of just shove them there in the writer's desk or wherever you put those. You don't want to hear that. You don't want to know about that. Well, anyway, there was this prophet named Isaiah. I'm British. That's the way the British people say his name. I know there's a deacon in our church in Wisconsin who would call it Isaiah. So that's where I got to stop. Jeff Robinson, I'm thinking of you today, brother. Sorry, that was just being, never mind. Isaiah shows up as a messenger from God with a message from God. And oftentimes the message was not a pleasant message. And what I want to do for just a couple of minutes, now that we've already looked at God's expectations of his people, let's take just a moment and look at Israel's performance. How did Israel do with these commandments that God had given them? Did they stay inside the boundaries or stay out of the boundaries? Turn to Isaiah chapter 1, if you would. Isaiah is a record of all the different prophecies or messages that God sent to Israel through the man Isaiah. And he's going to give what you could say a performance review on how well Israel has been doing staying inside the boundaries. I don't know if you've ever had those at your place of employment once a year. Or maybe if you have a healthy company, it's much more often than that, where your boss calls you in and you kind of are sweating bullets. Are they happy with me? Am I going to be the first to go? If something bad happens, what's going on? And what you want out of that is you want thumbs up from your boss, right? Well, let's see how many thumbs up the children of Israel get from God in this passage. Now, I want to point out to you, this is the very first chapter, okay? When Isaiah comes to town, he's coming guns blazing, okay? He's not like probably the way Toby would do it, kind of warm up to you, right? You know what? You've actually been doing okay in this area. You're doing great. Here, come give me a hug. Let me hug you a little bit. And then while I'm hugging you, I'll be like, you know, there's this thing, right? Isaiah's got a little bit more of a direct approach. Take a look at verse 2. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. Oh, man, here's the performance review. I wonder how's it going to go. Children have I reared and brought up. That's very accurate about what God had done for his people. Looking at them like kids. I raised them, grew them up. But they have what? Rebelled against me. And then he uses this crazy illustration. He says, the ox knows its owner and the donkey its master's crib, but Israel does not know. What does it not know? Who its master is. My people do not understand who's in charge, right? Verse 4, ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, children who deal corruptly. They have forsaken the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They are utterly estranged. So the first part of God's evaluation of their performance so far can be summarized like this. Number one, they are stubbornly rebellious. Stubbornly rebellious. God in this passage is the stunned parent. Have you ever been stunned as a parent? Behavior pops up from one or multiple of your children. Something gets totally out of hand that should have been this big and turned out to be this big, and you're just stunned. How in the world did we get to this horrible place? God is exactly that stunned parent going, what in the world is going on here? I took care. And he starts doing all the guilt trip things that parents do. You wonder where parents get their guilt trip stuff from? It's probably from here. I raised you. I put a roof over your head. Fill in the blank. I've taken good care of you. Why don't you give me any respect? Why don't you pay attention to the boundaries I've set up for you? Why are you always fighting me? Why are you rebellious against me? Take a look at this. He says, you're an offspring of evildoers, children who deal corruptly. This is not a great performance review. Stubbornly rebellious. It's not ignorantly rebellious, right? It's not that we didn't know. I didn't know how fast I was supposed to drive. I didn't know I was only supposed to worship one God. They knew and they did it anyway. Their rebellion is stubborn. Their rebellion is defiant. Their rebellion is knowledgeable. God sounds a little bit in this passage like a jilted husband or a jilted wife who just can't understand why their spouse left them for somebody else. But instead of humbling themselves and following God's instructions, the people have turned their own way, abandoned him, and you come to that last phrase of verse 4. They are utterly estranged. We don't use that word a ton, but it means where there once was close relationship, what do we have again? Separation. God's over here, and they're over there. God had done this amazing miracle. He rescued them from Egypt and brought them close to him, right? And over time, that relationship separates and separates and separates and separates to the point where they're completely estranged. And the sad thing is, they had every advantage. They knew exactly what they were going to do. They had a God who promised them blessings if they stayed inside the boundaries, and they instead chose to rebel and do their own thing. And they have no excuse. Now notice the second part of his evaluation here in verse 5 down through verse 10. God says, or I'm not sure if Isaiah is saying this or God is saying this, but Isaiah, as a representative of God at the very least, is saying this. Why will you still be struck down? Why will you continue to rebel? The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there's no soundness in it, but bruises and sores and raw wounds. They're not pressed out or bound up or softened with oil. And in case you're curious what he's talking about, verse 7 says it very clearly. Your country lies desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. In your very presence, foreigners devour your land. It is desolate as overthrown by foreigners. And the daughter of Zion, that's a way to talk about the people of Israel, is left like a booth in a vineyard, like a lodge in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. And then Isaiah says this, if the Lord of hosts had not left us a few survivors, we would have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. And then he says in verse 10, hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear to the teaching of our God, you people of Gomorrah. What is he saying here about them? He's saying this, number two, they are unresponsive to punishment. See, now this is where you get really freaked out as a parent. It's one thing for your kids to rebel stubbornly against you and your boundaries. I think probably that happens with quite a bit of regularity to some lesser or greater extent. The hard part is when you apply punishment and discipline into their lives and they still don't turn it around. When they face the pain of whatever consequence and they're still stubbornly defiant. And that is what God is saying about his people here. He's saying, look, I've been punishing them to try to bring them back to me. And instead of coming back to me, they're further away than they've ever been. And then he does this crazy thing. How would you like it if instantly, right now, your body was as sick as your soul is sick on the inside? And all of a sudden, we could look at your body and see how you were doing spiritually. That's the illustration he uses here. He says, your whole head is sick. There's bruises, there's cuts, there's open sores. Can you imagine walking around like that? You'd be ashamed. You'd stay at home in your house. You'd never come out. But our souls are like that. Israel's soul is like that before God. He can see down to the very depths of who they really are. And he's like, I've been in a sense punishing you and punishing you, trying to get you to come back, and you are really hurting. There's not a lot. Your cities are destroyed with fire, and there's foreigners that are coming in to invade and attack you and cause you all these troubles, and you still aren't turning around? You're still not crying out to me for forgiveness? You're still not trying to fix the problem that you've had? That's scary stuff. It gets so bad, he calls them. Did you notice what he called them at the end of those verses? He called them the rulers of Sodom, people of Gomorrah. Now, if you've been reading the story closely and stuff that I haven't had time to get to, you remember that in the Old Testament, there was a Las Vegas. Did you know that? In the Old Testament, there was a Las Vegas. It was twin cities next to each other called Sodom and Gomorrah. And apparently, anything went in those two cities. Their idea of welcoming new guests to town was to show up for a gang rape, okay? I'm sorry, but that's what the text is telling us. This is intense. And they became a bylaw or a byword or a figure of speech for the worst thing ever. What's Las Vegas's nickname? Have you ever heard of this? Sin City. We understand that there's a culture there that says everything goes. This is where you go, and then it stays in Vegas, right? We don't tell our people back home. We go to Vegas, we get our freak on, right? We get our freak out of our system, and then we go back home, and we're the straight-laced Midwestern or Northeastern people that we always claim to be. Go to Las Vegas, get your freak on, and then come back. In the Old Testament, it was go to Sodom and Gomorrah. That's where the crazy stuff is happening. You want pleasure, that's the place to go find it. And he's calling his people who have received his laws, received his instructions. He's saying those people have now set the bar for evil. They've taken away the crown from Sodom and Gomorrah, and now they're the ones that are setting the standard for evil. ESPN calls itself the worldwide leader in sports. I don't know if you've ever heard that expression, worldwide leader in sports. They have now crossed over to being the worldwide leader in sin, debauchery, and wickedness. His people, the people he gave the very explicit boundaries and guidelines to. Not a great performance review so far. Now, this is the part where it gets interesting, and I'm only going to touch on this because I really hammered on this last week, and I don't want to sound like I'm hitting the same note every week. Verse 11, God says this, "What to me is the multitude of your sacrifices, says the Lord? I've had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of well-fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. When you come to appear before me, who has required of you this trampling of my courts? Bring no more vain offerings. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath and the calling of convocations, I cannot endure iniquity in solemn assembly. Your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul," what does it say? "Hates. They have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them." Verse 15, "When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen." Why? "Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, remove the evil of your deeds from before my eyes. Cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression. Bring justice to the fatherless, plead the widow's case." The third part of this reformist review is that the people were hoping in religion. See, this is how it works out. This is how it plays out when you're a religious person. You grab on to the rules that you think are important, and you are really strict about following those rules. And anybody who breaks those rules, oh my goodness, who do they think? What wicked, terrible sinners. While at the same time over here, you have all the rules you don't care about, and you're breaking those left and right. And you're holding yourself to a standard of goodness, while over here you're ignoring all the things that matter. And this is what God says about his people. He says, "Who asked you to come?" You know who the answer to that is? God, you asked me to come. That's part of this worship thing, is I'm supposed to come to church. And God says, "Who asked you to come?" And what he means is this: who asked you to come like that? Who asked you to come with your hands dripping in the blood of innocence? and pretend that somehow coming to a worship service, offering me a sacrifice, is somehow going to get me to ignore the fact that over here you're oppressing people, you're hurting people, you're violent, you're wicked, you're evil, but you're coming to church. You're keeping your set of rules that you think are important, and you're ignoring the ones that matter. And God says, my soul hates that. My soul hates it when you think you're doing fine because you're picking and choosing your three or four rules. I'm going to keep those while you let the rest of them go and don't care. Do you think if a man were unfaithful to his wife and was with another woman, that when she complained to him about his unfaithfulness, he would have a right to look at his wife and say, but I do the dishes like every night for you. I take out the trash like clockwork. Have you ever had to pay the mortgage yourself? Do you think he's going to care? Do you think she's going to care that you pay the bills, that you do the external stuff? No, she doesn't care. Why? Because she has always wanted your heart, and she doesn't have it. And you've proven that by being with somebody else. God is saying the exact same thing. This is nothing different than that. God is saying, you promised to be faithful to me, and you've abandoned me to go off with the next God that came along. They're hoping in religion to fix the problem. And it's not working. God's not okay with it. God's not going to put up with that. So in summary, friends, if you look at this passage, Israel is failing miserably, okay? It's clear God expects her to obey him and, in fact, to be a model for the world of a whole new way to live, so that she could pass on the blessings of God to the rest of the world. But instead, she's being like the world she's supposed to be rescuing. She's jumped in board in a relationship with them and is ignoring God. The whole nation is stubbornly rebellious, unresponsive to punishment, and they're putting their hope in religion to keep God happy with them. But it is not working. God is not happy. Apparently, this sin problem we've been talking about, going all the way back to the second chapter in the story, when sin entered our world and caused havoc and destruction, this sin problem we've been talking about is much more entrenched in our hearts than a good few clearly articulated rules can solve. Because Israel's heart is divided. There's times she does want the good things. She does want to live right. She does want to stay inside the boundaries. But then there's lots of other times when she's over here wanting to live the life of a rebel, wanting to live out here and do her own thing. And this is not going to work. Israel is sabotaging her relationship to God and to each other. And Israel at this point has all but abandoned her mission to help the world be restored to God. Israel is funny. They're sinners who need to be rescued themselves. Remember we talked last week that God intended for them to be this holy group, a nation of priests that would be like matchmakers between God and the broken world, and they would help introduce people to God. They're not priests. They have the same problem the world has. Israel is actually part of the problem. She has the same disease. She is infected with the same disease of sin. And these sacrifices that they're doing to try to make it up to God are not getting rid of the sin. They're not dealing with the problem. They aren't turning Israel into anything right. Israel's not becoming what God intended for her to be. Even with all the blessings they've been given, they are no better, no different than the nations around them who don't even know about the rules. This is a pretty dark statement. This is a pretty dark point in the story, to be honest. And it feels like another dead end, doesn't it? God gives humanity this beautiful gift. Here's this world I want you to take care of, and we use that freedom to destroy the world he gave us. God gives Israel this opportunity, and instead of using it, Israel turns her back on God, and now Israel needs saving again. She needs rescuing too. Israel was supposed to be a bright light shining in a dark place, guiding the nations back to God, but instead, Israel is entrenched in a deep darkness that comes from their own stubbornly sinful heart. So the question is, what's God going to do now? right? He rescued Israel so that she could then help rescue the world, but Israel still needs rescuing from sin. What's God going to do? I was going to bow and pray right here, but I think that's probably a little dark. So let me try to transition. Because there's an incredibly great plot twist in the story that's about to come in right about this point. Do you like stories that surprise you? Do you like kind of watching along and expecting, and maybe it looks like things are getting really bad and then something happens? Like, I remember watching these really old westerns, right, where the good guys are inside the fort and there's the enemy on the outside and they're outnumbering them. They're like, what are we going to do? And then all of a sudden you hear and the cavalry has come, right, to rescue them and save the day. And you don't see it coming until you watch a couple westerns and you're like, okay, they always come, but whatever. You know, the plot twists, they're fun, aren't they? They kind of keep your eyes on the story. They restore hope when you think hope is lost. There's a plot twist coming in this story that is going to show us how committed God is to a happy ending for his story. And this plot twist will be revealed to the same prophet who gave such a horrible performance review to Israel for all of their failures. And that promise or that plot twist unveils itself in Isaiah chapter 9. Can I invite you to turn just a couple of pages to Isaiah chapter 9? Because we need some hope here. You came here today knowing humanity stinks. You knew that. I want to give you something else. Isaiah chapter 9, it's on page 573. Verse 1 of Isaiah chapter 9 says this, "But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations." Now look at verse 2. "The people who walked in darkness." Who's that? It's Israel. It's these people who the darkness is coming out of their hearts. The darkness isn't coming at them from outside. The darkness comes from within. "The people who walked in darkness have seen a" what? "Great light." And then he expands on that. "Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone." There's hope. There's something to look forward to. There's a plot twist. Well, look at verse 3. "You've multiplied the nation. You've increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil." Verse 4. "For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian." Those are rescue words. Those are rescue terms. Verse 5, "For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire." The great defeat has been turned into a victory of some kind. You're like, how did God pull that off? Look at what he's dealing with. People who had clear instructions and have done everything they can to go outside of those instructions. How in the world is God going to bring this rescue you talk about, God? Look at the glorious verse 6. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of his peace there shall be no end, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this." What's the plot twist? Somebody's coming to fix the problem. God doesn't give up on Israel or the world. Could he have? On multiple occasions? Has he had many reasons to give up on us as a race? You had better believe he has had reason. But he's not giving up. He is committed as ever to the happy ending. He's going to now slightly change in his approach. "The people who walked in darkness," Isaiah tells us, "have seen a great light." And that great light is going to be a special child who will be born to them. And the hope of Israel and the hope for the world through Israel is now focused not on the nation as a whole, but on one child that will be given to this nation. And when this child comes, he will bring the rescue that Israel and the world desperately need. What Israel is not able to do because of her sin, he will do on her behalf. He'll do it for her. Now, over time, this person, because many of the prophets start talking about this person, this child who would come, this ruler who would come. And there was a term that started to grow up around this person called the Messiah. If you've heard that word and never quite knew what it was talking about, here's what it refers to. Messiah is a Hebrew word that means anointed one. Anointed one? What are you talking about? In the Bible, whenever somebody would be chosen for a specific job, specifically a leadership job in God's people, they would have somebody official, usually a priest, who would take oil, and they would anoint the head of the person that has been chosen for the job, whether it's a king or a prophet or even a priest. That would happen, and it was a way of marking this person out as special. They have a special chosen job. And so the people of Israel started to call this child who would be born the Messiah, the chosen one, the one whom God has chosen to fix the problem. This child would flood a dark world with God's light to do something that Israel couldn't do for herself. Let me just point out really quickly three descriptions of this special child. Three things about this special child, this Messiah, who would be God's ultimate solution to Israel's problem. First thing is this. This child will, and this is gonna be tricky, but hang in there with me. This child will embody God to Israel. This child will embody God to Israel. What I mean by that is this. This child, when he is born, will not be an ordinary child, will he? If you look at this passage, it says this. He's the wonderful counselor. Well, that could be a person. That could be a human. That could be a normal person. Then he says this person will be called the mighty God. These are not terms you just use for people because you like them and they had a good day. You know, oh, thanks for, you know, giving me some extra coffee today. You're the mighty God. They didn't do that. That's blasphemy. You would get stoned if you called a person God in those days. And not just mighty God, he's called the everlasting Father. You don't have to read far in the Old Testament to realize that the ultimate father of the Israelites was God. He even called himself their father, right? Children I have reared, he says. This child who will come in some way, and this doesn't explain how that's going to happen, but when this child comes, he's not just going to be a normal child like David was, who was a good king, or these other good leaders. He's going to have this little time. No, this child in some way is also going to bring God to us in some crazy way that I don't fully yet understand from the story. We haven't gotten there yet. God is going to enter into the story as one of the main characters. He is going to come to Israel to do for Israel what Israel couldn't do for herself. He's planning an invasion. He's coming to bring God to his people. And that means he'll be qualified to deal with this sin problem we've talked about once and for all. What a crazy plot twist. God's not just going to be in heaven sending messengers and yelling down at us. He's going to come somehow as one of us, and he's going to do for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. Secondly, this child will rule over an eternal kingdom. Did you see that in verse 7? Of the increase of his government and of peace, there shall be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from this time forth and what? Forevermore. He's going to rule forever. Remember I said that Israel had their good days and their bad days? That their good kings and their bad kings? A good person would come along and say, we need to follow God. And the people go, yay! And then when that person died, the next generation would walk away. This king's not coming to last for 30, 40 years, give us a nice little blip on the radar, and then disappear so we can crash and burn again. When he comes, he's coming to stay. And when he comes to stay, he's going to stay forever. This kingdom he's going to rule is going to be an eternal kingdom. And that leads to the third thing, and this is the one that matters the most for our conversation. This child will make everything right again. Did you see that in verse 7? He says, of the increase of his government and of his peace, there will be no end. And then he says this, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with what? What does it say? Justice and with righteousness. What they're saying is this, Israel, you have been unrighteous. You have been unjust. You're violating all the people around you. You're oppressing people. You're killing people. You're taking advantage of God's gift to you. But when this Messiah comes, when he comes, he's going to set up a kingdom that is the opposite of that. It's just, it's right, it's fair. Everything that's out of balance, the world is turned upside down with injustice. He's going to take the world, and with the strength of his might, somehow, he's going to put it right back the way it's supposed to be. The world that you knew in the garden is coming back. The Messiah will be the one who restores it to the way it was always supposed to be. Justice and goodness and love. Humans in relationship with God and with one another ruling the world as God intended for them to rule. Can you begin to understand right now why the people of Israel during this time period started to long for the arrival of the Messiah? They look at their king, and their king's kind of a loser. They look at their own hearts, and they realize, wow, if it's up to me, we're not going to be able to do this. And so they would hear these stories about this child who would be born, and their hearts would fill with hope because they knew there was one day a rescuer coming. This rescuer would be coming from God, and he would be born to Israel, but he would somehow be God as well. And through him, all the injustices and imbalances of the world would be corrected and fixed and healed. Out of deep darkness, a great light would shine, and that light would change absolutely everything. So, what can we take away from this chapter in the story? Really quick. Number one, we can remember the sad reality that we humans cannot fix our own problem of sin. Our horrible tendency ever since our first parents walked away from God is to continue their example, to walk away from God ourselves, shake our fist in his face, and abandon him at the first sign of trouble. That's our tendency. And turning to religion isn't going to fix the problem. God's not going to be impressed by that. God wants your heart, and God's going to hold you accountable for that. We need to be honest with ourselves about this. We need to stop trying to pretend, okay, that somehow we can be the solution to our own problem that's going to come from us, okay, because we don't have what it takes. We can't perform our way into the rescue that we need. The second lesson, the last lesson is this. It's a simple one, but it fills me with hope. God is relentless. Relentless. What do I mean by that? Only this. God will not allow our failure to bring the story to an end. God will not allow our faithlessness to compromise his faithfulness. He is not going to give up on us, to give up on the happy ending for the story that he envisioned from the beginning. God is going to do whatever it takes to repair this damage. That's how committed, friends, he is to having a relationship with you. I wish I could just reach into your heart and convince you of that one thing. If I could convince you of that one thing, so much of your problem would be gone. Just that conviction that no matter what you do, no matter how far you go, no matter how stubbornly rebellious your heart is, God is relentless. He's not going to give up on you. He's going to keep working until it accomplishes his purpose. He's going to bring a Messiah. He's going to do a stinking miracle, okay? To bring God to earth in a way that has never been before so that you and I can have this thing fixed, and so that the relationship that has once again become estranged between God and Israel, and through Israel the world, God can once again, ultimately, forever, win us back and restore that relationship and change our story from a tragic story to a story of victory. So if you need hope this morning, let me tell you this. The Messiah came. He came for you. He came for me. And if you just reach out to him, if you just open up the door to him, if you just say, come on in, I don't know how you're going to rearrange the furniture, but come in. If you just do that, he can deal with this problem that you can't fix yourself. I cannot wait to introduce you in more detail to this Messiah next week. Cannot wait to give you the story about him. because it changes everything. God is relentlessly committed to rescuing you, and he will rescue you even today if you let him. Let's pray. God,